where we might find God in the wrestling that human beings are part of. There is a an old comedian, he's been on with us, George Carlin, I'm dating myself, because I saw him live a couple of times, George Carlin, figure that if we're going to talk about Bill Maher in a few weeks, I can finally use a George Carlin illustration. There's no cuss words, though. In one of his routines that I'll never forget, and it involved a phone, you remember, like, phones that actually plugged into the wall, he expressed astonishment at all of humanity that watched television, which is many of us, especially if you watch CNN and the Fox Network or anything like that, and they would do polls, and they'd ask questions. Now we have Dancing with the Stars, and you text in or call in to vote. But this was kind of a new, cool thing, and they were allowing you to call in, and then they'd have these so-called instant results. And he said, did you ever notice on those phone-in polls where people vote on their views, there's always, in that whole scheme of things, there's always like 18% who vote, I don't know. They always do that. It costs a dollar to make that phone call. It costs a dollar, he would say, and they're voting, I don't know. And so he imagined, he said, I can just see some guy seeing the question of the day on CNN underneath and say, honey, give me the phone. And he takes it, he dials it, and goes, I don't know. He takes a dollar. And then he closes by saying, sometimes you have to stand up for what you believe you're not sure about. That's sort of what these next 4 weeks, I think, might be like. Where human beings have a long tradition of trying to make sense of things we're not sure about. Why were we put on earth? Why if there is a God and God loves us, would the same God allow suffering and death to fall on the innocent the same way it falls on the guilty? Why, if we are to be followers of Jesus in Christian tradition, does it seem as though we're required to check our brains at the door when we enter the sanctuary? How come if Christians are supposed to be such a loving group of people, we are responsible for much of the hatred that's been spewed out for centuries? Much of it against homosexual persons, against women, against people of color, people who practice faiths other than our own, some of which we mentioned in our song, our best song, including hatred against people who have no faith. And the behavior by Christians like that results in, well, bullying and marginalization and self-hatred and even death. I can't tell you how many times when I lived in Napa, especially, I would get a phone call from a therapist network that had me as their spiritual backup sort of person. And I would say, hello, and the therapist would say, we have another one from there. There was a particular church. And if a woman was pregnant and didn't want to keep her baby, they would heap so much shame and grief upon her that they would be close to suicide. And so we would come together just to calm her enough to have a conversation, let alone. during her pregnancy, carrying him and his twin brother, that the tradition says she wanted to die before they were even born. And when they finally make their appearance into this world, Esau is born first, the older brother. Jacob is born, grabbing onto his heel, holding on. It meant that from the very beginning, they were fighting, tussling. And in order to get out of that place, from the very beginning, Jacob used someone else. His name, literally translated, can come out as trickster or supplanter. And it gives us a clue about how he's going to grow up, which he does. And eventually he cheats his brother Esau out of his whole inheritance. That's a whole other big story. He dupes his dad, whose name is Isaac, on his deathbed. Esau wants to kill him for this. But Jacob, he decided he would approach that problem spatially. And he pulls what maybe some of you have heard today called a spatial exit. He sets out for a new land, far, far away. That's a strategy a lot of people use. He goes to Haran, where his uncle lives, Uncle Laban. And on that journey, something else happens. It's kind of a mystical experience. And he lays down and goes to sleep. And in this instance, he has wonderful dreams. With the rock as his pillow, he has a dream that God comes to him and says, I'm going to bless you, and you're going to have a great land of descendants, and it will be like the dust of the earth, and you'll spread out your people. And I'm going to watch over you wherever you go. And eventually, I'm going to bring you back to this land that you're trying to exit from. And so God has this conversation, and that is what I would call a good dream. And then Jacob goes on his journey, and finally he arrives at his uncle's, where his next adventure begins, and all other kinds of intrigue happen. We're not going to talk about that either, but he ends up with two wives, as you heard Matt say. 20 years or so go by, and as he has lived and gotten married and had a family, he decides that it's time to go back. And he loads them all up, and they take off. He's about to get there, and he starts worrying. And so he comes up with a strategy to divide everybody into two, because then if those 400 slaughter one group, then the other will survive. He's a plotter. He's a trickster. He makes the strategy, and night comes. And he lays down, have another sleep. We don't know. Maybe he's expecting another one of those nice dreams where God's going to tell him what worry about him. But this is a little different. The scriptural account is pretty sparse, really. It says, Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him. Tell David. We know what that's like as human beings when night falls and you lay down and you want to rest, and then it starts going, right? The mind. All these questions, all these situations. We struggle. And like Jacob, it can go on and on. What do you wrestle with at night like? What do you struggle with? What kind of questions? His first question at that time was, is my brother going to kill me? What kind of person, maybe, have I been when years has passed? Who am I? What kind of questions do you struggle with as you lay trying to go to sleep at night? Well, if ever there was a book written about this, it was this Spiritual Envy by Michael Presley. Like Jacob, this guy goes round and round and round. I would say there might be a few thousand questions, literally, in this These are the questions of one who questions. That's how he describes himself. Many of us are like Jacob and like Michael Chiasson. And in the case of this man, his questions really began in adolescence, when he got to high school. His introduction sets the stage for the rest of his story by quoting a line from a British writer, and she said this: "I don't believe in God, but I miss him." And I would say that is Michael Chiasson's story. He was raised as a young Jewish boy, and always Michael was certain that God was with him. Always, completely certain. God watched over him. God was his friend. God was someone he could rely on. God was someone he could be fearful of. God was someone who was more like a Santa Claus, tallying up how you've been good and how you've not. It's much the same with Margaret, who you find in this book. Now, she's a fictional character, but as always, you know, she could be us. And Margaret is 12, and in this story, it spans her whole year. And the two of them, very similar, Margaret is 12, and Michael in high school, beginning to question God. Michael claims right away that he's an agnostic, who lives in the paradox that with increased knowledge, especially in our past 100 years or so, sees a corresponding harder time for all of us to believe anything. He sees a correspondence between our knowledge and our ignorance. That the more we know, the more uncertain we become. I'm going to quote him now. "As we have applied historical and archaeological scholarship to our understanding of scriptures and holy books, it has undermined faith," he says, "and created greater uncertainty about what has long been regarded as the Word of God." Michael Chiasson longs for certainty. Above all else, he wants to know about God for absolute sure. He cannot point to one experience in which he lost his faith. Rather, it was a gradual experience for him that began in high school, and that has been his companion ever since. As much as he longs for faith, though, and the reassuring presence of God, he never, ever has found it, so he says. And that's why he entitled his book, Spiritual Envy. Because he looks at others who say they have faith, and he wants to be like them. It's as though that Michael expects God's presence to be the same to him as it was when he was a child. And even as he's expressing his understanding of the world and the universe as forever changing, he doesn't seem to allow that for God. I want you to listen to Michael's description of trying to find the absolute in the inconsistencies, for example, that are found in the Bible. He says, "For many of us, the answer sides with agnosticism that there are no answers. The answer is that until further notice, there's no answer. But that does not preclude seeking answers, just as not believing in the soul does not preclude searching for experiences that feed what we think of as our soul. What feels like the soul in me," he says, "occasionally feels as if it rises to a higher level of being. I feel elevated when I felt elevated when I gave a short speech to 1,500 sworn-in naturalized U.S. citizens. I was moved by the ceremony and the ritual, just as I had been at commencements, where it seemed like a higher plane. Is it my soul that's affected? It certainly feels like something deeper, more profound than the word emotion can convey. And he said, I like to savor that feeling, which, like anything in life worth savoring, is much too fleeting. Our wrestling with God is much that way. Momentary moments of clarity, exhilaration, joy, sometimes even power and strength in the face of something. And then it's gone. And for Michael Krasny, he concludes that therefore there is no God. And for others, they conclude there is God, it's just hard to grasp. The story of Jacob and his wrestling match, as I said, goes long into the night. And finally at dawn, when the sun begins to shine, which maybe symbolically is going to come out of this wrestling match, Jacob's antagonist says to him, "Let me go. Let go of me." And Jacob says back, "I'm not going to let you go unless you give me a blessing." And so his wrestling partner says, "Well, what's your name, Jacob?" "Well, you're going to get a new name then. Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with human beings and have overcome." And then it's Jacob's turn to ask, "What is your name?" But there's no name given. Just that blessing. "Your name will be Israel, because you have struggled with God and with human beings and have overcome." You see, Michael Krasny was born into that very tradition. The tradition that named Israel the place of his holy studies and where his tradition came from. It was named after a struggle. I just find that so ironic. So who was Jacob struggling with? Was it God? Is that the way God comes to human beings? Is that what it's like for you in the night when you struggle? I'm going to turn us for a moment to a 12-year-old struggle, our friend Margaret. And she has the same kind of struggle, but it's, of course, voiced in Judy Blume's 12-year-old writing way. Margaret was raised with no religion. And it is an assignment at school to write about something important. That's the only direction you're going. So she has decided she's going to figure out her religion. And as she works on it, she realizes she's going to have to go check out some places she's never been in. Where people worship. And so she decides to start with the temple of her Jewish grandmother, who's overjoyed at her request. Margaret's parents aren't so happy with her. Margaret's mother is Christian and her father is Jewish. "That's ridiculous," Margaret's mother said when she told her. "You know how Daddy and I feel about religion. But you said I could choose when I grew up," she says. "You're not ready to choose yet, Margaret." "Well, I just want to try it out," I argue. "I'm going to try church too. Don't get hysterical." He didn't mean to say that. "I am not hysterical." I say that. "I just think it's foolish for a girl of your age, 12, to bother yourself. But on Rosh Hashanah morning, while I was still in bed, I decided to speak to God. having been raised, as I said, in the tradition, he ends up getting a PhD in literature. He teaches at San Francisco State. He has, you know, Forum as a national radio show, but if you've been raised in the Bay Area like I have, he's just a voice that's been on KQED radio forever. Another Lorraine County person, 2 weeks in a row, I have a Lorraine County author. The piece that grabs him the most once he gets to college and beyond is a play by Samuel Beckett called Waiting for Godot. Maybe some of you have read it. He refers to that over and over by saying, both Vladimir and Estragon, if that's how you say it, the two characters, wait and wait and wait for Godot, who never shows up. Now, Beckett himself has never said that play is about God, or not about God. But Krasny sure it is. And as Krasny's life goes on, he has interviewed, listen to some of these names, Michael Lerner, Alice Walker, Amy Tan, Herbert Bowl, Ravi Shankar, Ram Dass. He's been present with Joel Osteen, who's the guy that preaches the gospel of success, in a room with Reverend Moon. And in all of these interviews and times, he's been seeking and watching for what he comes to want to ask, which is, I want to believe fully in God's ultimate power, which would mean one believed God could do anything. That's his belief. Then he goes on to say, so why could I not enlist God to aid my declining father? He's going into Alzheimer's and dementia. This is when Michael is a man in his late 50s. Many of us struggle with those questions. And there's value in that struggle. There's value in the struggle. You know the story of a butterfly that is in a cocoon, and if you've ever actually gotten to see one come out of that cocoon, it's hard not to want to go and help it. But if you do that, most likely the butterfly's going to die because it needs that struggle, right? And I know that when we give birth, I know a lot of us have C-sections now, but that trip, right? I hope I'm right, Sarah. I think this is right, because Harrison didn't get the trip, and so we had to go into an incubator. The trip down, the birth canal, is really important to do all that squeezing and get all that stuff out to the lungs and be ready to take that first help there. It's not fun. It doesn't feel good. But that is a struggle that has to happen in order for life. Do you have struggles right now? Business struggles? Family struggles? Money struggles? Faith struggles? Personal struggles? I know you're not comfortable, but don't give up. If babies give up, you'd be in bad shape. The survival of Jacob after that night of wrestling maybe can give you some consolation and encouragement today. Hang in long enough, you get a blessing at the end. There are some words in another part of the Bible, a book called Romans, where the Apostle Paul says, all things work together for good for those who love God. And I would add, even the struggles. And people read that kind of quelling. All things work together for good. That's not what I mean. It means if you struggle, you might find life at the end. Then Paul in Romans goes on to say, if God is for us, who can be against us? The answer is nobody. Not some river wrestler on the side, not some double-crossing uncle Laban that Jacob goes to, not even his potentially murderous brother Esau, who he cheated out of all his wealth. she's excited. She's counting the days until she's going to go. And right before her trip, something really unexpected happens to her. Remember Jacob? Something unexpected happens when he lays down. Her Christian grandparents, who she's never met, who disowned her mother for marrying her Jewish father 14 years prior, send a letter and say they're getting old and they want to meet Margaret, and they have talked to their pastor and they've rethought their choices that they made 14 years ago. They want to revisit that, and they come for her. And Margaret is forced to stay home from the war. Can you think of anything worse? And the dad is mad at the mom because he says, how did they get her address? And Margaret knows, and mom says, she sent them a Christmas card. Get the irony? A non-practicing Christian sent a Christmas card to her parents. She says, I only signed our names. They start arguing. But they decide Margaret will stay home, and they will be seeing her parents. They meet. They get acquainted. They sit around the table. And they have a meal together. And eventually the conversation comes around. The grandmother assumes that Margaret's in Sunday school. Margaret says, I don't go to Sunday school. And the grandmother's upset. What do you mean? And Margaret says, I'm no religion. And the grandmother says, yes, you are, and you're a Christian. You were born a Christian. Your mother's Christian. That makes you a Christian. And the argument follows. Fight, 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 back and forth, between all the adults. And finally, Margaret says, stop it! I hollered. I jumped up. All of you, just stop it. I cannot stand another minute of listening to you. Who needs religion? Not me. I don't need it. I don't even need God. And she stomps off to her room and she says, I was never going to talk to God again. What did he want from me anyway? I was through with him and his religions. And it's really hard, but she stops speaking to God. And I say it's really hard because she's become in the habit of her own their God. It's me, Margaret. Getting her through every day. It proves really harder than she ever imagined. But she succeeds for a little while, and she freezes God out. Have you ever done that? Had similar experiences where you argue and you fight over religion and right belief, and then you decide, we're going to freeze that out, we're just going to all get along. Not going to talk about that stuff. We can do it. We can have a meal together. We don't have to talk about that stuff. Or maybe that's not your fight at the dinner table. Maybe you have a different set of struggles. Maybe it's making the house payment or paying the dentist bills or the pain in your body day in and day out or the roof that's leaking or the crabgrass. That is driving me nuts out front. Or the schedule of the carpool that keeps changing. Or the traffic jams. Or the tax audit that comes at the worst time. Or lawsuits. Or leaf blowers that start right when you get home from work. Or relax. Barking dogs that start. Just when you're home. Maybe it seems as though life may suffer no real crushing blow, but it just goes on and on day after day. No high for most. Sun comes up, sun goes down. Or maybe there really are some struggles that are not like that, but they shape us to our roots. A marriage that starts to not feel like a marriage anymore. It's beginning to crumble. Our children who become rebellious in church, but I had to leave the confessional because I didn't know what to say. I've not tried being a Buddhist or a Muslim because I don't know any people of these religions. She went to every church or synagogue. I've not really enjoyed my religious experiments very much. And I don't think I'll make up my mind one way or the other for a long time. I don't think a person can decide to be a certain religion just like that. It's like having to choose God sends me down